knowing agreement came out of the rest of us, showing that we'd pretty much reached the limits of what we could make out of the morning's activities. For a while we just ate and drank, letting our nerves and our spirits piece themselves back together. But the silence was eventually broken by Miss Howard. "For a woman whose original action seems to have been so impulsive," she said slowly, sipping her wine and playing with the dish of fresh strawberries and hot chocolate sauce that had arrived for dessert, "this one seems to have planned how to elude capture awfully well." She gently bit into a dripping strawberry. "Another paradox, I suppose, Doctor?"
"Indeed, Sarah," the doctor answered, rolling a strawberry of his own in the chocolate. "But remember, all of you, remember, these paradoxes must not be considered contradictory. They are part of a single process. As a snake propels itself forward by pushing sideways across the sand, first to the left and then to the right, so does Nurse Hunter pursue her desperate goals. She is impulsive, then calculating. Flattering and promiscuous, then suddenly and mortally threatening. An apparently respectable woman with a bedridden husband, who nonetheless seems to have some important connection to one of the most degenerate, senselessly violent gangs in the city. By comparison, more outwardly excessive criminal behavior seems quite comprehensible. Even so obsessive a murderer as John Beecham moved along a course that almost appears linear and coherent, even though it was fatal, when held up against this woman. We find ourselves in many ways in an even stranger land when we face Elspeth Hunter, and with fewer maps. The meal soon came to an end, and it being Sunday, and all the places what Dr. Kreisler had mentioned as possible sources of information being closed, everyone agreed to go home, take care of what few details they could, and try to get some rest. As we left the Café Lafayette, the Isaacsons hailed a hansom while the doctor offered to drop Mr. Moore and Miss Howard off. Then it was back to 17th Street, and, for me, into the carriage house to take care of the calash and put a little balm on the spot on Frederick's haunch where he'd been struck by Ding Dong. The blow hadn't left much of a mark, but I could tell as I applied the balm that it still stung Frederick a bit, and I made some calming noises and fed him a bit of sugar as I rubbed the medicine in. It made me all the madder to think that a man I'd always counted as one of the worst I knew, and, since visiting Cat the night before, had come to hate even more, had caused Frederick such pain and confusion. And as I worked on the animal's haunch, I quietly assured him that I'd see that the wound was taken back out of Ding Dong's hide one day, with interest, too. Caught up in these bitter thoughts, I barely noticed Cyrus slipping into the carriage house. He came over and stroked Frederick's neck, looking straight into the gelding's eyes and giving him some words of sympathy. Then he spoke to me.
"He okay?"
"Yeah," I said, holding up Frederick's left hind leg and scraping some hard mud out of his shoe. "Not much of a welt. Scared him worse than anything."
"He's a tough old boy," Cyrus said, patting the horse's snout lightly.
Then he came round and stood by me. I got the feeling he had something on his mind.
"Miss Howard didn't hear what Ding Dong said about Cat, I mean."
My heart jumped a little, but I kept on scraping. "No?"
"She was too far away, and she had her hands full."
Cyrus crouched down beside me. In a quick glance, I saw some inquisitiveness in his broad face, but more sympathy.
"I heard it, though."
"Oh," was all I could answer.
"You want to talk about it, Stevie?"
I tried to summon up a light, dismissive kind of a laugh, but came up far short. "Not much to say. She's gone to be his girl." I almost choked on the words. "I told her, you know, about the idea of her working here. But you were right, she's got other plans." Cyrus just made a small sound that said he got the picture. Then he put a hand on my shoulder.
"You need anything?"
"Nah," I said, still staring at the horse's hoof. "I'll be okay. Just gotta finish up out here, that's all."
"Well, there isn't any reason for the doctor to know this part of the story. Doesn't have anything to do with the case that I can tell."
"Right." I finally managed to give my friend another quick look. "Thanks, Cyrus."
He just nodded, stood up, and left the carriage house slowly.
I stayed at my work for several more minutes, the caked mud in Frederick's shoe coming away quicker as it mixed with my silent tears. Chapter 19. It's a peculiar thing how you can go to bed one night convinced of a fact and wake up the next morning to find yourself faced with its opposite. When I drifted off soon after sunset on that Sunday evening, I was dead certain that I would never see Cat again. Even if my heart could have stood visiting her at the Duster's joint, things had so fallen out with Ding Dong during our jaunt to Bethune Street as to make even an attempt at such a visit worth my life. The realization that the door on my strange relationship with her seemed to have suddenly swung shut alternately angered and saddened me all through Sunday afternoon and evening. So black and blue did my mood become, in fact, that the doctor, preoccupied as he was with the case, felt the need to visit me in my room and ask whether I was feeling all right. I didn't tell him the true story, and he of course sensed that I was holding something back, but he didn't press it, just told me to get some extra sleep and see how things looked in the morning. I woke at just past 8:30 on Monday to find the doctor and Cyrus getting ready to head up to the Museum of Natural History. Mrs. Leshko was, not for the first time, late, and Cyrus was seeing to the preparation of coffee, a task what he could accomplish with far happier results than could our Russian cook. The three of us sat in the kitchen and had big mugs of a fine South American brew, the doctor trying to cheer me up by reading aloud the details of a lead story in the Times that concerned new developments in the mystery of the headless body. It seemed that the lower torso of the still unidentified corpse, wrapped in the same red oilcloth what Cyrus and I had seen at the Cunard Pier, had washed up at the watery edge of the woods near Undercliff Avenue, all the way on the north side of Manhattan. The police, whose theory of a crazed anatomist or medical student had been dismissed even by the coroner they themselves had engaged, after the man had found about a dozen stab wounds and a couple of .32-caliber bullet holes in various parts of the body, had changed their theory and were now trying to drum up panic and excitement by saying the body belonged to one of two lunatics who'd escaped from the state asylum at Kings Park, Long Island, a couple of weeks earlier. This story, we all knew, was as likely to prove true as the first. But whatever the real identity of the unfortunate soul whose body'd been distributed all over town, the attention that the case continued to receive could only help us to go about our work more easily. The doctor and Cyrus headed off at a little before 9, and though a visit to the Museum of Natural History would ordinarily have been my sort of fare, the morning was a cool gray one, and my spirits were such that I found the idea of staying home alone somewhat comforting. And, of course, it was advisable that someone stick around and try to determine what in the world had become of Mrs. Leshko. So I walked the pair of them out to the calash and saw them off, pausing to glance up at the misty sky before heading back to the house. I had just gotten the door open when a voice whispered to me, "Stevie." It was coming from beyond some hedges on the east side of the doctor's small front yard. Carefully closing the front door again, I crept over to the hedge, looked up and over it, and found Cat. She was crouched down low and huddling by the side of the building next door, her clothes looking very wrinkled, her hair undone, and her face a picture of exhaustion. I couldn't have been more surprised if she'd been a ghost or one of those mythical sirens, so resigned had I become during the last 12 hours to never seeing her again. "Cat?" I said, keeping my own voice low. Then I rushed around the hedge to her. "What the hell are you doing? How long you been here?" "Since about 4, she said, glancing up and down the block, more so she wouldn't have to look me in the eye than because she was trying to locate anything. "I think..." Her eyes turned watery. She began to sniffle hard and painfully, and when she wiped at her nose with a filthy old handkerchief, it came away bloody. "But why?" She shrugged miserably. "Had to get out of there. He was like a maniac last night. In fact, I ain't so sure he ain't a maniac sometimes." "Ding Dong," I said, to which she nodded. My eyes fell to the ground. "It's my fault, ain't it?" She shook her head quickly, the tears thickening in those blue eyes that still refused to look into mine. "That wasn't it. Wasn't most of it, anyway." She finally sobbed once. "Stevie, he's got 3 other regular girls. 3! And I'm the oldest. He never told me that." I had no idea what to say. The information didn't surprise me, of course, but I wasn't about to tell her so.
So, I tried, did you two have an argument or something?
We had a fight, is what we had, she said.
I told him I don't play second fiddle to no 12-year-old piece of trash.
She slammed her fist against the side of her forehead. But now all my things are down there.
I smiled a little.
All your things?
Kat, you got 2 dresses, 1 coat and a shawl.
And my papa's old wallet,
she protested. The one with my mother's picture in it, that's there too.
I gave her a straight look.
But that ain't what's making this hard, right?
I touched her elbow, trying to get her to look at me.
He won't give you any Bernie, will he?
Bastard, she grunted, sobbing again. He knows how much I need it now. He swore he'd never cut me off.
She finally glanced once into my eyes, real pathetically, then threw herself against me, hard.
Stevie, I'm just about going out of my skull. I'm hurting for it so bad.
I put my arms around her shivering shoulders.
Come on, I said. Let's get inside. A little strong coffee'll take some of the edge off of it.
I got her up and half carried her to the front door of the doctor's house, where she paused once, fearfully.
They're all gone, right?
She said, looking up at the parlor windows.
I waited for him to go. I don't want you getting into no trouble.
They're gone, I said, as reassuringly as I knew how.
But there wouldn't be any trouble anyway. The doctor ain't that way.
She let out a doubtful little noise as we went inside. I guided her to the kitchen and a mug of Cyrus's coffee. Her eyes got wider as she began drinking it and taking the house in. And I'll confess that, seeing the look in those eyes, my notion of bringing her to work for the doctor resurfaced in my thoughts. So I took her on up to the parlor to let her get the full effect of the place. Strengthened by the strong coffee, she began to move around more bravely and even smiled, amazed at all the wondrous and beautiful things the doctor owned, and even more amazed that I lived in such a place.
"He must work you to the bone," she said, opening the silver cigarette case on the marble mantel.
"It ain't the work that's tough," I said, sitting in the doctor's chair like I was lord of the house. "He makes me study."
"Study?"
Kat said, her face filling with near disgust. "What the hell for?" I shrugged. "Says if I ever want to live in a house like this, that's what's going to get me there."
"Who's he kidding?" she answered. "I bet it wasn't studying that got him here."
I just shrugged again, not wanting to admit that the doctor came for money.
"I can see why you like it so much, though,"
Kat went on, looking around.
"Beats hell out of Hudson Street, that's for sure."
At the sound of those words, a thought suddenly occurred to me, a thought that maybe should have jumped into my head as soon as I saw Kat, if only worrying about her hadn't, as usual, scrambled my mind up so much. "Kat," I said slowly, considering the thing, "how long you been spending time at the Duster's joint?" She sat down in the big easy chair across from me, holding her arms into her like she was cold, and then shrugging as she sipped at her coffee.
"Dunno, maybe a month or so. First met Ding Dong about then, anyways."
"You know pretty much who comes in and out of there then, I guess, right?" She shrugged again.
"The regulars, sure, but you know that place, Stevie. They got swells from all over town slumming every night. Half the city's been through there at some point or other."
"But the regulars, you would recognize them?"
"Probably. Why do you want to know?"
She got up and moved over to me.
"What's that look on your face, Stevie? You're acting so odd all of a sudden."
I just stared at the carpet for a few seconds, then grabbed her hand. "Come on with me." Making for the staircase, I half-dragged Kat up to the doctor's office. The drapes were still drawn in the dark paneled room, and it was hard to make anything out clearly. I tripped a couple of times on my way to the window, and when I gave the drapery cord a good tug, I saw that it was still more piles of books what had waylaid me. The study was an even bigger mess than it had been the previous week. Kat glanced around, frowning and wiping at her nose.
"This room don't do much for me," she said, mystified and put off. "What's he want with so many damn books, anyway?"
I didn't answer. I was too busy going through papers on the doctor's desk, looking for something, hoping that the detective sergeants had left at least one copy. I found it, lying underneath a thick book by Dr. Kraft Ebbing.
one of the photographed copies of the sketch that Miss Beau had done of Nurse Hunter. Moving it closer to the light that came in through the sheer white curtains that still covered the windows, I signaled to Cat that she should join me. "You ever seen this lady?" I asked, showing her the picture. Her face filled with recognition right away. "Sure," she said. "That's Libby."
"Libby?
Libby Hatch, one of Gugu's malls," she went on, referring to Gugu Knox, the leader of the Dusters. Cat's face twisted up in that way it did when she didn't understand something, like her nose had been attached to a drill bit. "What the hell's your doctor pal doing with a picture of Libby? A good one, too."
"Libby Hatch," I said quietly, looking out the window for a few seconds, enough time to realize that, as Miss Howard had said the day before, this whole thing was a lot more complicated than it had originally looked.
Again I grabbed Cat's hand. "Come on." She flew along behind me like a rag doll as I ran back for the door, then spun round again and headed back to the desk, slapping open a leather-bound book of addresses and telephone numbers with the doctor kept on it.
"Stevie," Cat said, "do you think you could quit yanking me around like that? I ain't exactly feeling athletic, you know."
"Sorry," I said, opening the book to the I section with one hand, finding a number and then charging back to the door with Cat still in tow.
"Ow," she cried. "Stevie, are you listening to me at all?"
I didn't answer as we shot back down to the kitchen, then through to the pantry. Finally, letting go of Cat's hand, I grabbed hold of the telephone's receiver and mouthpiece. In a couple of seconds, I had an operator on the line, and I gave her the number of the detective sergeant's house, or rather, their parents' house, what was located down on 2nd Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues, next to the old marble cemetery, and not far from two or three synagogues. The phone on the other end rang, and a woman's voice answered, yelling into the thing the way people who still considered it a fantastic invention were like to do.
"Hello?" the woman said, through a thick accent. "Who is da?"
"Yes," I answered. "I'd like to speak to one of the detective sergeants, please." Cat took a step back, looking worried.
"Stevie, you ain't calling the cops on me?"
As usual, her first calculation was that anything what happened had something to do with her.
"Relax," I said, shaking my head. "It's business."
I liked the feeling of being able to tell her that.
"Go get yourself some more coffee. We got an icebox, too, if you want."
I stopped when I realized that the woman on the phone was yelling at me.
"Detective Sergeant? What von? Lucius or Marcus?"
"Huh?
Oh, either. It doesn't matter. Marcus is not here. Headquarters. I get Lucius. Whom ist calling?
Just tell him it's Stevie."
"Stevie?" she repeated, not sounding too impressed. "Stevie who? Stevie what?"
I was getting a little impatient.
"Dr. Stevie,"
I said, raising a small laugh out of Cat, who'd gone to investigate the food in the new icebox.
"Business," she said, giving me a cunning little sideways glance. "Sure." "Oh, Dr. Stevie," the woman on the line said, satisfied. "Only just a moment, please."
She set the phone down with a crash that echoed into my ear and made me pull my receiver away.
"Jesus Christ," I said, hoping my eardrum wasn't busted. "Whole damn family's nuts."
In a few seconds, the phone on the other end rattled around again, and I heard Detective Sergeant Lucius speaking, though not into it.
"No, Mama, Stevie isn't a doctor. He just... Please, Mama, go."
There were some unidentifiable protests from the woman, then Lucius again.
"Mama, go!"
He took a deep breath and spoke into the phone.
"Stevie?
Right here."
"I'm sorry about that. She still doesn't really understand this thing, and I don't know that she ever will. What's going on?" "I got some news, and I think it'll save you and Detective Sergeant Marcus some work. Can you collect him and get over here?"
"I can come," Lucius answered. "I've been doing the chemical analysis of the sample I took from the tip of that stick, but I just finished. It is strychnine, by the way, but Marcus is poking around down at headquarters, then going on to the doctor's institute. Why?"
"I think you'd better tell him to come up," I said. "What I've found, I think it's important."
"Where's the doctor?"
"Him and Cyrus went to the museum already. They shouldn't be too long, though. Can you make it?"
"I'll get a cab now and try to intercept Marcus at the institute." He yelled away from the telephone again.
"No, Mama, that's the chemicals you're smelling. There's nothing to clean."
His voice came back to me. "I've got to go before my mother sets herself on fire. See you in half an hour." The line clicked, and I hung the receiver up. Wandering back into the kitchen, I found Cat had scared up some eggs and a few herring and was getting ready to fry them in a big skillet.
"So," she said with a smile, "how's business?"
I was too amazed by what she was doing to hear the question.
"Cat, you can cook?"
"Don't give me that kind of air," she answered playfully. "You think me and Papa had servants, Mr. Stevenson Park? I cooked for him all the time. Eggs and herring, now that's a breakfast." She tried to crack an egg into the pan, but her hand shook badly, and as it did, she lost her smile and took a deep breath.
"Say, Stevie," she said quietly again, without looking at me, "does your doctor friend have, well, you know, does he see any patients here?"
I said, shaking my head and knowing full well what she meant by the question. "None of that, Cat. It's just..." Her hand shook again, and her eyes filled with those sickly, desperate tears. "I don't know if I can crack the eggs." My mind seemed to grab hold of a thought, something the doctor had said when I'd been at the Institute, and he'd dealt with a kid who was in even worse shape than Cat. Something about what a cold cutoff of drugs could do to the human body. I knew that, in fact, he might have some cocaine stashed in the small examination room he maintained toward the front of the house on the ground floor, but I wasn't going to let Cat have it. When she suddenly let out a little cry, though, then grabbed at her gut and sat down quick on a chair, I figured I'd better do something, so I ran to the examination room and opened a little glass case what held a series of bottles. Looking them over quick, I came across some paregoric tincture. I knew that people gave it to colicky babies, and such being the case, I figured it couldn't do Cat any harm. I ran back out into the hall and then to her, crouching down. "Here," I said, handing her the bottle. "Try some of this." She kept one hand on her stomach and moaned as she took a deep pull off the bottle. Then she held the thing away from her and stuck her tongue out. "Ugh, what the hell is that?" "Just something to calm your gut down." "I need Bernie," she answered with a little stamp of her foot. "Cat, there ain't any here. Just try to stay calm. Take another shot of this." I held the bottle to her head as she shook it, trying to avoid the foul-tasting medicine. But after another swig, her nerves did seem to calm down some. "Better?" I asked. She nodded slowly. "Kinda. Phew." She finally took her hand away from her stomach, got a deep breath into her lungs, and stood up. "Yeah, that is better. Maybe some food now, huh?" I walked her to the stove. "I still ain't so sure I buy this cooking business out of you." Cat was able to laugh a little at that, and when she picked up another egg, her hands were steady. "You wait, boy," she said, cracking the little brown shell on the lip of the skillet with practiced skill. "You're going to wish you had this breakfast every day." She winced once, then turned to the table. "Give me a little more of that stuff, will you? Tastes awful, but it helps." As she labored over the eggs and herring, Cat took not one but several more shots of the paregoric, and her mood brightened considerably. The next half an hour or so was one of the happiest times I can remember spending with her. Just making breakfast and eating in the kitchen like two ordinary types, chatting, laughing, forgetting for the time being what had driven her to the doctor's house. She began to talk about the day when she'd have a big, beautiful house of her own, and though I didn't believe that whoring would ever lead her to such a place, I didn't say anything to interfere with the daydream, so chipper and healthy did it make her seem. In fact, I was a little sorry when the front doorbell finally rang at a little past 10 o'clock. I had just set to washing our dishes, and Cat had lit up a smoke, still romancing away about her future, and even joking at one point about how she'd hire me to work in her house. I'd never thought of that idea before, me and Cat under one roof as adults, not even in my own moments of dreaming. Nor could I conjure it up that morning, so outside the realm of possibility did it seem. Her imagination, I suppose, was a lot better than mine. Had to have been, when I think about it. Drying my hands on a kitchen towel, I started running for the front door, Cat joking about my being her butler and telling me to send whoever it was away, as she was not receiving that morning. She straightened right up, though, when I came into the kitchen with the two detective sergeants. She still wasn't completely sure that their visit didn't have anything to do with her. I introduced them to Cat, and together the four of us went on up to the parlor, where they all sat down. For my part, I ran further on to the doctor's study to fetch the picture of Nurse Hunter. When I brought it back down, I found the Isaacsons arguing, in their usual testy, childish way, over the exact ratio of chemicals that were supposed to be used in the test what Lucius had conducted that morning. Cat was sitting on the edge of the same easy chair she'd been in before, glancing over at the two men and wondering, I'm certain, what in the world kind of cops behaved in such a way. "Here we go," I said, taking the picture to Cat as she stood up. "Cat, tell the detective sergeants who this woman is." She just stared around at the three of us for a second, then mumbled to me, "But I already told you." "Yeah," I whispered back, "but tell them. Don't worry, it ain't going to get you in any trouble." "I heard that before," Cat answered. Then she spoke aloud. "Her name's Libby Hatch. She's, well, her and Gugu..."
"Gugu Knox?" Marcus asked.
"Chief of the Hudson Dusters?"
"That's right," Cat said. "She's his girl. Well, she's one of them anyway. They all got plenty, the sons of—"
Cat caught herself and cut her fuming short.
"But she's his favorite right now."
"Libby Hatch?"
Lucius said, taking the picture. "You're sure?"
"Sure I'm sure. I got eyes, ain't I?"
Lucius gave Cat a careful squint.
"You wouldn't happen to know where this Libby Hatch lives, would you?"
Cat nodded quickly. "Right around the corner from the Dusters' headquarters, Bethune Street. She's married to some old geezer, but he's half dead anyway, so she has to look out for herself. Gugu's got their house under the gang's protection. Anybody gets caught even casing the place, they'll end up in the river. And they won't be swimming, if you take my meaning."
Lucius was about to say more, but then Marcus held up a finger.
"Miss Devlin, I'm sorry. Would you excuse the three of us for a moment?"
"Sure,"
Cat said, looking ever more confused, and then turning to me.
"Stevie, maybe I could go downstairs, have a little more of that medicine?"
"Yeah, sure, Cat," I said. "It's right where we left it." She tried to smile at the detective sergeants.
"Just a little stomach complaint. I'll be right back."
Lucius and Marcus watched her go, Lucius looking very excited about the news we'd received. He was about to express that excitement when Marcus stepped in again.
"Stevie, how do we know that this girl can be trusted?"
The question took me a little off guard.
"How?"
"Well, because. She's a friend of mine. I've known her for a long time. Why shouldn't you be able to trust her?" Marcus looked me straight in the eye.
"Because she's a prostitute and a cocaine fiend."
My pride got ruffled for just an instant. But it was clear from Marcus's look that he didn't mean to cause any injury. He just wanted to be sure that we weren't, in fact, getting taken. I looked to the floor as I answered.
"Neither of them things makes her a liar, Detective Sergeant. I'll answer for Cat."
"The cocaine fiend, I understand," Lucius said to his brother, looking puzzled. "The indications are fairly clear, but why do you assume she's a prostitute, Marcus?
A girl that age? Living at the Dusters? It's not a mission house, Lucius, for God's sake."
"Hmm," Lucius said grimly. "True. But she does know where the Hunter woman lives. And what could she possibly gain from telling us all this? I say we believe her, not least because it could make all our lives a lot easier."
"How so?" Marcus asked.
But it was me that Lucius spoke to next.
"Stevie, do you think this girl might do us a favor?"
I shook my head. "A favor? Probably not. I got her into a little hot water yesterday. Anyway, Cat's life hasn't made her one for favors. But if there was something in it for her, then yeah, I think we might ask her."
I looked at them both earnestly. "But only if it ain't dangerous."
"It shouldn't be," Lucius answered eagerly.
"What are you cooking up, Lucius?" Marcus asked.
But at that moment, Cat came running up the stairs and back into the room.
"Stevie, there's people coming into the house."
"Don't worry," I said, going to the stairway. "Probably just the housekeeper. I've been wondering when she'd turn up."
"No, it's a couple of men," Cat answered quickly, following me. "Stevie, it's your doctor. I shouldn't be here. He'll take it out of your hide."
Looking down the stairs, I saw that the new arrivals were, in fact, the doctor and Cyrus. Putting a quick hand on Cat's arm, I squeezed it gently.
"Don't worry," I said, half amused by her fear. "I told you it'll be fine. He ain't that way." "But we've been eating his food, and the medicine—"
"Calm down," I said, as the doctor started up the stairs at a jaunt.
"Go inside, it'll be fine, I'm telling you."
Cat nodded reluctant agreement, but didn't move. And as the doctor reached the top of the stairs, she drew back behind my shoulder, her eyes going big as she took in his long dark hair, his black eyes, and the clothes that matched those eyes even in summer. I smiled. I'd flat out forgotten how imposing, even scary, he could look when you first met him. "Stevie," the doctor said, seeming satisfied, "we have returned, though rather more quickly than I'd hoped. Apparently this area of anthropology is just developing. It took half of Boas's staff, in addition to several students from Colombia, to analyze the arrow, and their explanation was only partial. The weapon does indeed originate in the islands of the southwestern Pacific, though there remains some confusion over—" He stopped suddenly when he made out Cat's little form hiding behind me. "Well," the doctor smiled genuinely but slowed his approach, "I didn't know you had company, Stevie. My apologies for bursting in so rudely." Cyrus came lumbering up the stairs, calling out to me, "Stevie, you feeling all right? There's a half-empty bottle of paregoric on the kitchen." Then he, too, caught sight of Cat. "Oh," he said, scrutinizing her. He smiled just a bit and bowed his head. "Hello, Cat," he said, courteously but not exactly warmly.
"Mr. Montrose?"
Cat noised from behind me without moving. The detective sergeants came out of the parlor, and the doctor looked past me and Cat to them. "Ah! The detective sergeants as well. Good. This will save some time." He turned the careful smile my way again. "Stevie, am I not to be introduced?"
"Oh," I said. "No. I mean, yes. I mean—"
Cat jumped out from behind me ever so briefly and extended a hand, looking like she thought the doctor might bite it off.
"Catherine Devlin, sir," she said.
The doctor had just touched the hand when Cat snatched it back and got behind me again.
"Stevie didn't invite me, sir. I just come of my own."
"Friends of Stevie's are always welcome," the doctor answered simply, "though I think we'll all be much more comfortable in the parlor, don't you?"
I could feel Cat's small breasts rising and falling quickly as she pressed herself against my back.
"I think I should go," she said anxiously, but I held her back. "Cat, it's okay," I insisted again. "Come on, I want you to tell the doctor what you told the rest of us, and the detective sergeant's got something he wants to ask you."
Very reluctantly, Cat moved with our group back into the parlor, though she never came out from behind me as we went. Her blue eyes stayed fixed on the doctor. She'd convinced herself a long time ago that he wasn't on the level, and his kind attitude was only making her more edgy and suspicious. The doctor went to the mantel and got himself a smoke, offering one to Marcus, then lit up and sat in his chair. "Please," he said, indicating an old, or I should say antique, French settee, what was near me and Cat. "Won't you sit down?" He seemed almost as amused by her attitude as I was, but he very decently kept that amusement to himself. She just nodded once, then sat and fairly broke my arm and neck as she yanked my shirt hard and forced me onto the settee beside her. Shoving up against my side, she let her panicky stare leave the doctor only long enough to see what the detective sergeants were up to.
"Miss Devlin has brought us some very useful information," Lucius said, handing the photograph to the doctor. "It seems that she has some acquaintance with Elspeth Hunter."
The doctor's politeness suddenly grew mixed with excitement in a way what made his eyes glow hot, which only caused Cat to grow even more nervous when he looked back at her.
"Really, Miss Devlin, you know the woman?"
"I don't know what he's talking about," she answered, giving Lucius a quick jerk of her head. "But if you mean Libby Hatch, then yeah, I know her."
"Cat spends some of her time at the Duster's place," I added, not wanting her to have to explain it. "She says they know Nurse Hunter as Libby Hatch, and that she's one of Gugu Knox's girls."
"Gugu?"
the doctor said, confused.
"Ah, yes, Knox. The strong man of the Dusters. I must say one can only speculate as to the amount of cocaine that the members of that gang must abuse in order to invent these absurd names."
Cat gave out with a sudden sound that I thought might be alarm, but when I turned to her I found that she was smiling and that the noise had been something like a laugh. For the first time she looked as though she might be buying that the doctor was okay. The doctor laughed along with her, very encouragingly.
"So, Miss Devlin," he said, and I could see that Cat liked being referred to that way, "you say that the woman in this picture is on romantic terms with Knox."
She's his special Moll just at the moment, Cat answered.
Indeed, the doctor replied.
And, Lucius added pointedly, Knox has her home under his personal protection.
Does he really?
The doctor looked to Cat again.
For any particular reason that you can think of, Miss Devlin?
Cat shrugged and loosened her grip on my arm a bit. He's a wild one, is that Gugu, and from what I've seen, so's Libby. They spend a lot of time upstairs in his room. I hear it gets a little crazy sometimes. I also hear that she dances for him.
Dances? The doctor echoed, a bit confused.
Glancing out the window in some embarrassment, Cat nodded. You know, sir, dances. He'll have the band come up and play outside his door, and she dances.
It finally dawned on the doctor that Cat was talking about something what was known in those days by a number of different terms, but which we now refer to by what it is, the striptease.
I see, the doctor said quietly. Do excuse my ignorance, Miss Devlin. I don't mean to be thick-headed.
Oh, no, sir, she answered very respectfully. Ain't no reason why you should know. Anyway, like I say, at the moment she's the one of his girls that can really keep up with him, even more than the younger ones. She works at it, does that, Libby?
Libby,
the doctor repeated softly, bouncing the knuckle of his forefinger against his mouth as he waited.
Libby.
He turned to the detective sergeants.
An alias?
Marcus considered it with a little shrug.
Libby could be a diminutive version of Elspeth. It's likely she had or has one, as Elspeth is fairly archaic.
Hatch could be her maiden name, Lucius added. She's using it in situations where she doesn't want to be identified. You're not going to get many nursing jobs if it gets around that you're dancing for Gugu Knox. But there's a more important consideration here, Doctor.
Lucius approached him, glancing briefly at Cat.
There are two things we need to do at this juncture, forensically. We need to prove that the child is in Nurse Hunter's home, and we need to demonstrate that Nurse Hunter was in fact responsible for the attack in Central Park.
He gave Cat another look and a very friendly smile.
I believe that Miss Devlin can help us with both things.
Cat turned to me, speaking quietly.
Stevie, you said there wasn't going to be no trouble.
There ain't, Cat, I answered quickly. Not for you. Then what's all this about a kid and an attack?
All this is nothing in which you need fear you will be implicated, Miss Devlin. The doctor tossed in from his chair. The detective sergeants are investigating a case. We are providing them with some help. Our motives are that simple.
Grunting a little as she turned back to the doctor, Cat took on a defiant look. I don't want to get mixed up in any police investigation, she said, especially not if it's got to do with Gugu. He'd as soon beat somebody half to death as look at him even when he ain't blowing the Bernie.
There might, Marcus said, what you could call delicately, be a rather substantial consideration involved, Miss Devlin.
Cat squinted at him. You mean, like money? Marcus nodded. Money don't do you much good in the hospital, and not when you're at the bottom of the river, neither.
And if it were enough money to ensure that you never had to return to Hudson Street again? The doctor asked.
Cat's face went blank. How could that be? If I cross the dusters, even just one tiny bit, there won't be a place in this city I can hide.
The doctor shrugged. Are you so attached to life in this city? Perhaps you have family in some other part of the country.
And I assure you, we wouldn't be asking you to do anything dangerous, Lucius said. Everything's dangerous when you're dealing with that bunch,
Cat answered quickly.
Then she eyed the doctor again. I got an aunt. Lives in San Francisco. She's an opera singer.
Really? The doctor said enthusiastically. They have a most promising company. Is she a soprano, a mezzo?
An opera singer is what she is, Cat answered, not knowing what in the world the doctor was talking about, and looking at. She sent me a letter once after my papa died, saying she could get me work as a singer, too. I can sing. Stevie's heard me.
Cat turned to me, expecting some support. I just nodded hard and said, Oh, yes, she can sing, all right.
even though I'd never thought that much of her voice. But I got a tin ear, and always have had, so I can't say. Maybe she could sing.
Well, then, the doctor said, one ticket to San Francisco, by rail or by sea, whichever you choose, and, say, a few $100 to acclimate yourself.
I'd never seen Cat's eyes grow so big.
All in exchange for...
The doctor suddenly stopped and turned to Lucius in confusion.
Detective Sergeant, what the devil is all that in exchange for?
Lucius turned to Cat again, maintaining his smile.
A garment with buttons,
was all he said. Cat stared at him, her mouth hanging open.
A garment? You mean, like clothes?
Clothes might do, Lucius answered. An outer garment would be best, though, something she would be sure to wear in her own house, as well as at the Duster's. And on the street, too, if possible. A coat or jacket of some kind would really be ideal.
I get it, Marcus said, slapping his forehead. Of course.
Cat looked at the pair of them like they were even crazier than she'd first thought.
A coat or jacket, she said.
With buttons,
Lucius answered, nodding.
With buttons, Cat said, nodding along. Any particular kind of buttons?
Large ones would be best. The larger the better.
And flat, if possible, Marcus added.
Yes, Lucius agreed. Exactly.
Cat stared at them for a few seconds, then opened her mouth to speak. Unable to find words right away, she turned to me, then back to them. And the blue eyes narrowed as her mouth curled into a slight smile.
Let me see if I'm getting this. You want me to lift one of Libby Hatch's jackets or coats, one with big, flat buttons. And for that you'll give me a ticket to San Francisco? And a few $100 to set myself up?
That, the doctor said, himself looking a bit uneasily at the Isaacsons, is, apparently, what we are offering.
Cat turned to me again.
They serious, Stevie?
Generally, I answered with a smile.
The thought of Cat leaving town didn't set me up much, that was true, but the idea of her getting away from Ding Dong, the Dusters, and all that went with that life outweighed any other consideration.
Come on, Cat, I urged. Lifting a coat? You could do it in your sleep.
She slapped my leg hard.
Ain't no reason to tell the world that, Stevie Taggart,
she scolded quietly. Then she looked back to the others and stood up.
All right, boys, gentlemen, you got yourselves a deal. It may take me a day or two.
The sooner the better,
Dr. Kreitzler answered, standing and extending a hand.
But a day or two should be fine.
Cat shook his hand, much less skittishly this time, then smiled wide.
Well, she said, I'd best get about it then.
Turning to me, she took on a bit of a coy air, play-acting like she had in the kitchen.
Stevie, will you?
She stopped, realizing she didn't know the words.
Show you out, I finished for her. Yeah, sure.
The doctor pulled out a few dollars and handed them to me.
See her to a hansom on the corner, Stevie.
He bowed to Cat. It's been a pleasure meeting you, Miss Devlin, and I look forward to the successful conclusion of our business together. He glanced at Lucius once more. Whatever that business may turn out to be. I took Cat's arm and we headed out of the house. Once on the sidewalk and moving toward Second Avenue, she began to jump around like a four-year-old.
Stevie, she near screamed, I'm going to California. Can you believe it? Can you imagine it? Me, in San Francisco.
You really got an aunt, an opera singer? I asked, as she came close to strangling me by throwing her arms around my neck.
Well, practically, Cat answered. She works in the opera house anyways. And she'll be a singer some day, she told me.
Uh-huh, I said, not completely convinced.
She ain't no floozy, is she, Cat?
No, she ain't no floozy, thank you, Stevie,
Cat answered, and I ain't gonna be either, not no more. My life's gonna change, Stevie, change, and all I gotta do is steal a jacket from Libby Hatch.
Steal a jacket from a woman what has trouble keeping her clothes on, from all I can tell.
We'd reached the corner, directly across the avenue from the New York Lying-In Hospital, I noted, and as I hailed a hansom, Cat's face screwed up one more time.
What do you suppose they want such a thing for, Stevie? The doctor and them two fellows.
They strange birds, those two, for cops.
I don't know, I said, suddenly realizing that, in fact, I didn't know. But I'm going to find out. I turned to her as she opened the little door of the hansom.
You'll be okay, Cat? I mean, about Ding Dong and all?
Him? She answered. He'll be lucky if he even sees me before I pull this off. Let him have his little 12-year-olds. I'm going to California.
You'd better write to your aunt first, I advised. Make sure she's still there and that it's all okay.
I already thought of that, Cat answered, stepping off the curb. I'm going to do it tonight.
She paused before boarding the hansom to give me a hug.
Thanks, Stevie,
she whispered into my ear. Your friend, and that's the truth. Pulling back, she glanced at the doctor's house once more.
And you was right about your boss. He's a decent soul, sure enough. Though he looks like one of the devil's own, that I will say.
I wanted badly to kiss her, but she hopped into the cab, waving the few dollars I'd passed along to her up with the driver.
Hudson Street, cabbie, and take your blasted time. I want to enjoy the ride.
The cabbie cracked his whip. Cat gave me a little wave, and then she turned around to take in the avenue. She looked for all the world like she owned the city, and that made me smile. I turned and ran back to the house as the cab disappeared, wanting to know what in the world the detective sergeants had been talking about. Chapter 20. Coming back into the house, I almost ran headlong into Dr. Kreitzler, who was standing outside his small examination room, holding the paregoric bottle what I'd left in the kitchen. He launched into a bit of a lecture about my taking it on myself to dispense narcotics. It seemed that paregoric was an opiate which explained why it was so effective on both colicky babies and the desperate cat. I told him I had no idea it was so strong, being as anybody could buy it just about anywhere. He answered that he understood why I'd been driven to make use of it, given Cat's condition, which he, like the detective sergeants, had quickly detected. Still, he didn't want me taking any more medicines out of the examination room without his permission, as he didn't much like the thought that he'd have to start locking stuff up. This deserved but no less unpleasant lecture was cut short by the sound of the doorbell. Its two tones, produced by a small, electricity-driven hammer striking a pair of long pipes in the vestibule, were particularly loud, given as we were so close, and they startled both myself and the doctor. He sealed up the paregoric bottle tight, then put it into his examination room and said only, "I hope we understand each other, Stevie." I assured him that we did, and then he headed for the vestibule. Before he'd even opened the front door, I could hear Miss Howard's protesting voice coming through its thick wood. She was answered by a couple of low, mumbling words from Mr. Moore, and then Miss Howard broke into protests again. When the doctor opened the front door, she dashed through the vestibule and into the hall, looking flushed and annoyed, but smiling a bit despite herself.
"Stop it, John. The job's done. You don't have to go on."
Mr. Moore came loping in, giving Miss Howard a lusty look what seemed to be only half serious. "I don't care," he said. 2 hours in that hall, I'm going to make you pay." The doctor looked at them both in bewilderment. "It's a bit late for spring fever, Moore. What the devil are you up to?"
"You don't have a sedative, do you, doctor?" Miss Howard said. "Apparently, John decided this morning that if he behaved like a disgusting pig while we were at the Hall of Records, he might be released from his assignment. He's been at me all morning."
"Oh, I haven't even started," Mr. Moore said, making a move at Miss Howard. "You don't know what disgusting is yet, Sarah."
"Moore," the doctor said, grabbing his friend lightly by the collar, "I should have thought such idiocy beneath even you. Kindly pull yourself together. We've had important developments, and now that you're here, we can all go down to number 808 and review them together."
"All right," Mr. Moore said, his eyes fixed on Miss Howard. "I can wait." She just turned and looked into the big mirror that hung in the front hall, securing her hair more tightly at the back of her head as she did.
"I'm afraid I really will have to shoot you one day, John. Do you still have the diagram?"
"Yes, yes," Mr. Moore answered, finally dropping the act and standing up straight. He produced a folded piece of paper from inside his jacket. 2 hours, Kreitzler, in that musty old tomb. Did you know they used to keep prisoners there during the Revolution? And all we come away with is a blasted pencil sketch. Still, I suppose it might have taken us 2 days."
"Then you found something?" the doctor said, ignoring Mr. Moore's whining. "Records?"
"Only a copy of the permit," Mr. Moore answered. "The plans themselves have, quite mysteriously, of course, disappeared."
The doctor looked from Mr. Moore to me, his satisfaction and excitement obvious.
"Well, interesting developments on all fronts."
He rushed over to the staircase, calling up,
"Detective Sergeants, Cyrus, downtown."
Then he turned to me. "Stevie, will you tend to Gwendolyn and then follow along behind us? We'll walk down Broadway to number 808 so that the detective sergeants and I can tell these two about your discoveries of this morning."
"Okay,"
I said, moving to the door to follow the order.
"But I want to hear why the detective sergeants want that jacket."
Miss Howard looked confused.
"Jacket?"
The detective sergeants and Cyrus had reached the bottom of the stairs.
"Back to number 808, I take it?"
Marcus asked.
"Indeed," the doctor said, "and quickly."
They all began to file out as I went to the calash, Mr. Moore bringing up the rear at a slow pace.
"I don't suppose it's lunchtime yet," I heard him mumble pathetically.
"God, I never would have believed that detective work could give you such an appetite. It's no damned wonder so many cops are fat."
I gave Gwendolyn a lighter-than-usual brushing down and stowed the harness and gear without bothering to clean it all, telling myself I'd tend to the job later. Then I was back outside, making sure the carriage house was securely locked, and on down 17th Street toward Broadway, scanning the crowds of Monday morning workers and shoppers for my friends. I finally caught up to them as they crossed 14th Street from Union Square. My timing was a little slow, though. The doctor and the detective sergeants had finished telling Kat's story a couple of blocks earlier, and I'd just missed Miss Howard's summary of what she and Mr. Moore had found downtown. She, however, very decently fell out of the pack to give me a quick repetition. Some 2 years previous, Elspeth Hunter and her husband, Micah, had indeed applied for and received a permit to do some fairly extensive work on their house, most of it in the basement. But being as the actual records concerning the construction were missing, and the copy of the permit didn't go beyond generalities, that was all that we could determine, and lucky to have that much, too. But Miss Howard had sat Mr. Moore down after they learned this, and forced him to remember everything he could about said basement, which he'd actually been encouraged by Nurse Hunter to search. Miss Howard figured there had to be some kind of a clue in the area somewhere, so she'd sketched and noted its dimensions and everything that Mr. Moore could remember it containing. Nothing about the place had jumped out at them so far, but it was possible they were overlooking or misinterpreting something what the detective sergeants might think was important. We'd reached number 808 Broadway before Lucius began to explain what he wanted with Elspeth Hunter's, or Libby Hatch's, jacket with the big buttons, and the doctor decided that we should wait until we got upstairs to grill him about it. Lucius wasn't what you'd call a flamboyant or vain type of person, but like his brother had said that night we fetched them from the Cunard Pier, he did enjoy his occasional moment of intellectual grandstanding. And as we rode up in the elevator, the big smile on his face made it plain that he was pleased with the fact that none of us, except for Marcus, of course, had figured out what his plan was. For all that I was curious, I kind of admired Marcus for not spilling the beans and for giving his kid brother a moment to shine. It was an unusual outward demonstration that, underneath it all, the brothers really were deeply attached to each other, as they would have had to have been to have survived their years of struggling together up through the ranks of the police force. We got upstairs, and through the front windows of the office I could see that the clouds beyond the Hudson to the west were thickening, loading up with what looked like might turn into real rain. Everybody grabbed a seat, and Lucia stood by the big chalkboard, picking up a nib of chalk and shaking it around in his closed hand just the way the doctor liked to do. Lucius had the greatest admiration for Dr. Kreitzler in a kind of boyish way that sometimes made him seem to want to emulate the man in small ways as well as big. Repeating, for Mr. Moore and Miss Howard's benefit, his belief that what we now required above all was proof that Nurse Hunter had the Linares baby and had actually attacked the Senora in the park, Lucius proceeded to explain why so simple a garment as a jacket with buttons could provide such proof. The bit about the buttons, once I'd heard it, was pretty obvious, and I felt a little like kicking myself for not having thought of it. The detective sergeants had been able to get a good set of fingerprints off of the piece of lead pipe they'd found by the Egyptian obelisk, and they needed a set of Nurse Hunter's for comparison. They hadn't wanted to actually steal anything from her house, being as she seemed like the type that would notice if even the smallest trinket was missing. and given that the Hunter House had turned out to be under Gugu Knox's personal protection, it seemed a lucky thing they'd made the choice they had. But we still needed something that they could lift prints from for comparison. An article of clothing with buttons would suit best, as there weren't likely to be any prints on the fasteners save her own, and big flat buttons would be spacious enough to provide complete images of multiple fingertips. That left the question of why Lucius wanted a jacket or a coat, something that Nurse Hunter was likely to wear at home and outside. This question, in turn, brought us into what was, for the rest of our group, a mysterious new world, hair identification. It seemed that forensic science had progressed to the point where a microscope could be used to determine if a given hair was human or animal, and if it was human, whether it had come from a particular person, provided a sample of the particular person's hair was available for comparison. Now, the little hat what the doctor had spotted at the base of the Egyptian obelisk had contained what Lucius was sure were a few of Anna Linares's hairs. Baby hair was, it seemed, the easiest kind to identify, being, in Lucius's words, short in length, rudimentary in character, and possessed of extremely fine pigmentation. So what we needed now was another sample of Anna's hair, one taken directly from an article of Nurse Hunter's clothing, what could be put into the detective sergeant's comparison microscope, a kind of double-barreled job that would let him study the two samples side by side and make an exact match. But why, we all wanted to know, had Lucius decided on a jacket or a coat as the best garment to try to collect such a sample from? Didn't it make more sense to try to grab a shirt or maybe something even a little more intimate? The detective sergeant's answer was clever and worthy of the man. We already knew that Nurse Hunter had taken the baby out, bold as brass, in public, figuring that no one was ever going to nail her for the kidnapping, being as she had no interest in a ransom, she probably enjoyed every chance she got to make the world think that she was capable of having a happy, healthy child of her own. Shirts, skirts, undergarments, all those she wore inside at the Dusters and God only knew where else. And as we now knew that she wasn't exactly put off by close physical contact with a variety of types, those garments would likely contain a large number of hair samples what'd take a lot of time to sort out. And time was pressing us harder. If her experiences at the lying-in hospital were any measure, it wouldn't be long before Nurse Hunter's proven inability to give infants effective care began to show itself. At that point, even a baby like Anna Linares was likely to become a lot more cranky than usual, a condition what would only deteriorate. If Nurse Hunter held the kid responsible for the failure of their relationship, as Dr. Kreitzler believed she had in the past and would again, it was only a matter of time before little Anna, too, started having unexplained episodes of labored breathing, the final one of which would result in her death. And so a coat, or, as was more likely during even that comparatively cool June, a jacket, a garment what would immediately be removed whenever Nurse Hunter entered a place where other people congregated, thereby cutting down on the number of hair samples that'd be present, but what she would wear when carrying the baby, as she'd done on the Third Avenue L, tight, close to her bosom. It was a slick piece of reasoning. And as Detective Sergeant Lucius finished it up, we all, including his brother, gave him a little round of applause. The others were anxious about whether or not Cat would be able to get the article of clothing in question, but I quieted all that nervousness down. Without saying as much, I let them know that there wasn't much in the run of everyday items that Cat couldn't lift if she had a good reason. Then came the question of what to do about Nurse Hunter's basement. Miss Howard posted the diagram she'd made on the wall, and the rest of us went over it closely. The others proceeded to pound Mr. Moore with detailed questions, most of which he couldn't come close to answering, even though he'd had free access to the space.
"I was looking for a baby, for God's sake," he protested after someone asked him if he'd noticed any areas of concrete or masonry that appeared newer than the rest. "I didn't know I was supposed to be making an archaeological survey." "It was a typical basement. It had a furnace, it had some cabinets, some garden tools, and a dirt floor. I think there was a rack of preserves, too, though I wouldn't swear to it, and the usual, you know, artifacts of domestic living. Old pieces of furniture, a few picture frames." "And this was the arrangement of it all?" the doctor asked, studying the diagram. That's it.
The doctor made a noise of disappointment.
There's certainly nothing remarkable in any of that. The key, I should think, will be to find the contractor who did the work.
Oh.
Miss Howard looked up, her eyes going wide like maybe something had gotten by her that she hadn't realized she'd missed.
But he's dead, we asked.
The doctor spun on her. He's what?
Dead, Mr. Moore threw in simply. Died right after the job was finished. Apparently he was a friend of the clerk we spoke to at the Hall of Records. Did a lot of research work down there.
The doctor began to rub his temples.
Did the clerk happen to say what he died of?
He did, Mr. Moore answered, absent-mindedly rummaging through his pockets and coming out with an old piece of wrapped butterscotch.
Ah, sustenance.
Moore, the doctor said impatiently.
Hmm?
Oh, right, the contractor. Got his name right here. It was on the permit. He pulled out a scrap of paper as he sucked noisily on the butterscotch. Henry Bates. His office was in Brooklyn. Anyway, he had a massive heart attack a couple of days after he finished the Hunter job. And I don't blame him. Working for that lady'd give me a heart attack, too.
The doctor just shook his head in his hand, sighing. Miss Howard grew ever more nervous as she watched him. Do you think it's important, doctor?
He lifted his head, pulling at the skin under his eyes with his fingers.
It does strike me as an odd coincidence.
Yes. We've already had one coincidence on this case, Mr. Moore announced, waving a careless hand. You can't take stock in too many of them.
I shouldn't take stock in any of them, Moore, the doctor thundered back. Were they, in fact, coincidences? Marcus, I suggest that you find out what you can about a contractor named Henry Bates in Brooklyn. It may well be that he had a family.
And they'll know his medical history, Marcus said, noting the name on a pad with a nod.
Miss Howard clutched at her forehead. Of course. Damn it.
What the hell are you all getting so worked up about? Mr. Moore asked, and I'm bound to say that even I thought he was being a little dim at that point.
So the man had a heart attack, so what?
Moore, the doctor said, trying to be as patient as possible, do you happen to remember Dr. H.H. Holmes, the mass murderer whose existence caused your grandmother so much distress last year?
Of course I do, he said. Who doesn't? Killed who knows how many people in that torture castle of his.
Precisely, the doctor answered. The torture castle, a seemingly unending maze of secret rooms and chambers, each designed by Holmes himself to serve some horrendously sadistic purpose.
Well, Mr. Moore asked, what's that got to do with this?
Do you know the first thing that Holmes did once the castle was completed?
Mr. Moore's face stayed simple.
Killed somebody, I'd imagine.
Correct. He killed the one person on Earth, besides himself, who knew the exact plans of the place.
Finally, Mr. Moore's noisy smacking of the butterscotch came to an end.
Uh-oh.
He looked up slowly.
That wouldn't have been... Yes, the doctor answered quietly. His contractor.
Glancing from one of our faces to the next, Mr. Moore suddenly stood up. I'm going to Brooklyn, he said, racing toward the front door before any real abuse could be shoveled onto him.
I'm going with you, Marcus said, following. The badge may come in handy. We need the exact cause of death, the doctor called after them as they closed the elevator grate, as well as any details of the job that he may have shared with his family should he have had one.
The front door banged closed, and the rest of us were left to listen as the doctor mumbled in discouragement,
I ought to have known better. It's hard enough to keep John's mind focused in the cold weather, but in the summer...
He paused and looked at the diagram on the wall again.
The basement, he repeated softly. The basement.
Miss Howard came over to stand by him.
I really am sorry, doctor. I was the one who should have thought of it.
The doctor attempted to be gracious.
I doubt that it's cost us too much time, Sarah, he said, and even if we do discover some terrible secret about the construction of this basement, the question remains, what can we do about it? A direct approach by the police, given Señor Linares's attitude, is ruled out, not only because of the danger to the señora, but because of diplomatic privilege as well.
The denizens of Mulberry Street, even if we could convince them to investigate the matter, would never defy the wishes of a foreign dignitary. And the dangers to our own group of returning to the house are now clearly evident. One word from Elspeth Hunter, and we should find ourselves, as Miss Devlin said, at the bottom of the river. And then there is the question of our unidentified friend with his arrows and knives. Were you able to discover anything about all that? Lucius asked. I received pieces of an answer, the doctor said, to which it is necessary to add a conjecture, a rather bizarre conjecture, in order to obtain a likely answer. We are presented with two weapons. The first, as you said, Detective Sergeant, is the well-known trademark of the pirates, mercenaries, and simple thieves who haunt the Manila waterfront. The second is more obscure, an aboriginal weapon, as we surmised, one which, if judged by its small size alone, we could do no more than identify as originating with one of the pygmy tribes of either the southwestern Pacific, Africa, or South America. It is the strychnine that permits us to be more specific. It is known to be used in this way only by the natives of Java.
Java? Lucius said, but Java's in the Dutch East Indies, far to the southwest of the Philippines. It wouldn't seem to match with the Kreese.
True, Detective Sergeant, the doctor answered. But you must bear in mind what the waterfront of Manila is, a stewpot of everything violent and criminal from as far away as Europe, San Francisco, and China. An habitué of the place is likely to become familiar with weaponry from much farther away than Java, and if he is ethnically predisposed toward a particular weapon, the chances are all the greater that he will adopt it.
What do you mean? Miss Howard asked.
The doctor finally turned and walked away from the diagram.
In certain isolated parts of the Philippines, the northern part of the island of Luzon, for instance, and the Bataan Peninsula, there exist small groups of aboriginal pygmies. The Spanish and Filipinos call them Negritos. Their own tribal name is Aetas. They are the oldest residents of the islands, thought to have crossed over from the Asian mainland when there was still an ice bridge over that part of the Pacific. They are quite negroid in their features. The doctor looked to me and Cyrus, and their average height is about 4.5 feet, which might make them appear at a distance. Cyrus nodded, to look like a 10-year-old boy in this country.
Precisely.
Miss Howard suddenly gave out with a gasp.
My God, she whispered.
The doctor turned to her.
Sarah? You have, I suspect, recalled something from one of your conversations with Senora Linares.
Yes, she answered blankly, not bothering to ask how the doctor had guessed. Her husband. He comes from an old diplomatic family. When he was a young man, his father was posted to the Governor-General's office in Manila.
The doctor only nodded.
On the island of Luzon, there had to be a connection. The Aetas are outcasts in Filipino society. If one of them should, for whatever reason, have found himself in Manila, virtually the only place where his presence would have been tolerated would have been on the waterfront. He would have brought with him the aboriginal hunting and warring skills of his people, and in all likelihood picked up other methods of combat necessary for his survival. At the same time, like many aborigines, the Aetas place a high premium on loyalty. Should such a man ever have been employed or befriended by someone in a position of power? He turned to Miss Howard. It will be for you, Sarah, to contact Senora Linares somehow and determine whether or not her husband ever had such a man in his employ.
It won't be easy, Miss Howard said. She's being watched very carefully day and night.
Then we must be creative, the doctor answered. But we must know. This mysterious little man's behavior has been marked by two apparently contradictory intentions. We must find out why, so that we can determine when or if we are likely to encounter him again.
As he crossed back to the sketch on the wall, his voice grew discouraged again.
None of which, I fear, solves the problem of this bloody basement. How do we get in? And once in, how do we discover what she's created there, and if, in fact, she is keeping the child within it?
Lucius grunted. There aren't many times that I'd advocate the department's usual methods, he mumbled, but in this case, what I wouldn't give to break the door in and get down there with a good old-fashioned bloodhound to smell the baby out. Everyone fell silent for a minute or two.
I just sat there in my windowsill, knees tucked up under my chin, waiting for one of them to come up with a more practical idea. In such a state of mind, it took a few minutes for me to notice a small noise. Cyrus, gently clearing his throat in, it seemed, my direction. I looked over to find him staring at me, raising his eyebrows in an expression that appeared to say, "Well?" I had no idea what he meant by the look, and I wrinkled my eyebrows and hunched my shoulders to tell him so. At that point, he looked to the others, making sure they were still staring at the diagram, and then wandered over to me, leaning on the window frame and looking outside so that what he said couldn't be seen or overheard.
"You still know that boy downtown?"
he mumbled, casually putting an arm on the window frame and a hand across his mouth.
"The one with the animal?"
For a minute, I was